Thanks, Ganesh. So I'm not going to, I'm a bit more mundane than landing on the moon, but a force, an old school force of disruption, which is actually the housing sector. I suspect that most of you have a fairly large exposure to the housing sector. Everyone lives somewhere, so you will personally have a large exposure to the housing sector, but it's actually one of the main domestic disruptive forces out there in the Australian economy at the moment. There are a lot more, obviously, offshore, but in terms of domestic disruptive forces over the next year or two, the housing sector is about it. So I want to run through a bit what's been going on there and where things are likely to go, because, as I said, if you've got any domestic exposure, then it's probably got something to do with the housing sector, and it probably may be that the effect of the housing sector on the economy is actually a fair bit more than people often appreciate, but also it's a lot less than a lot of people seem to think it is as well. It's obviously the popular topic of any number of conversations around barbecues and dinner tables, generates reams of newspaper stories, basically funds a bunch of newspapers, and also generates a hell of a lot of reality TV shows. So it's also disruptive to the house, to the entertainment industry if the housing sector goes into a downturn. You could be thinking, forgiven for thinking that the housing market is the Australian economy, but that's not the case. But at the same time, developments in the housing market, in both the established housing market and the housing construction, have a broader impact than the simple numbers would suggest. This has been known for a very long time, but often housing cycles have occurred simultaneously with other events. For example, the housing downturn in the early 90s occurred at the same time as the recession then. And as a result, it can be difficult to fully isolate the direct effect of the housing market itself from the other forces at work. We have models which go some way towards doing this, but they also tend to suffer from the problem of trying to disentangle the various factors at play. But over the past few years, the housing cycles have moved in different directions and varied quite considerably around the country. The construction and price cycles are clearly highly connected, and both reflect the standard economic forces of supply and demand. Both cycles often move in sync, but this time they haven't been. So this current cycle presents the possibility to more clearly understand the differing effects of the housing construction cycle and the housing price cycle. And also the large variation in both cycles across cities around the country also means that we can separate out the effect of some macro factors which are common across the country and hence shouldn't be a driver of the differences across states. In particular, throughout the last decade, interest rates have been the same across the country, but we've seen very, very different housing price and housing construction cycles. Today, I'm going to discuss the evolution of the housing market and its effect on the economy. Some of the channels of transmission have occurred as expected, but some have been more unexpected. I'll talk first about the construction cycle, and then I'll talk a bit about the, if I can work out how to do this, yep. Then I'll talk about the house price cycle, which is the one most people think about. Then I'll examine how each of the two cycles has spilled over to activity and inflation in the broader economy, and then I'll talk about some developments on the lending side. So the housing construction cycle in Australia, in aggregate, clearly turned down at the end of last year. That brought to an end a long upswing at the national level that started in 2012. This downturn in the housing sector was not preceded by rising interest rates, which makes it a particularly unusual cycle because nearly every other housing cycle in the past was preceded by rising rates. This time around, the dynamics of supply and demand have been paramount. So the cycle started following a pickup in population growth in the mid-2000s that was by and large unexpected. It took a while for construction, the supply side of the market, to respond to this increase in demand. Started to do so around 2012 when there was a solid upswing for the next 4 years. One factor contributing to the slow response of supply was a historically high share of high and medium density housing. So what I've got here is just the spending each quarter on new construction of detached and higher density housing, as well as spending on alterations and additions. So you can see there that the large increase in high density spending. So it's around about the same amount of spending going on higher density buildings around the country now as on detached housing. But higher density houses on average are a bit cheaper than detached housing. So that spending translates into 2.5 higher density apartments being built for every detached house in the economy at the moment. So that is a long, long way away from where we've been in the past. So just to repeat, for every house, detached house that's being built in the country at the moment, there are 2.5 higher density apartments being built. The lead time for high density construction is long. A higher density development also requires more certainty around demand before going ahead, given the developer is trying to sell more dwellings at the same time. And that's relevant for the pre-sale financing too. And then once construction's actually underway, it takes about 2 years to build higher density housing compared with around 9 months for a detached house. So the greater share of higher density means the construction response to changes in demand is probably slower on the way up, and it's definitely slower on the way down, as higher density is harder to stop once it's underway. Detached housing construction is generally more flexible than higher density construction, though in Sydney and Melbourne in particular, the higher density and detached housing construction are in very different parts of the city. Higher density is generally inner city, and detached housing, particularly in Sydney, is almost entirely on the urban fringe now. But the construction cycle has been mostly an East Coast story, particularly Greater Melbourne and Sydney. Western Australia has also had its own construction cycle, which was very much driven by the resources boom. The WA cycle shows the importance of incomes and population dynamics in driving the construction and price cycles. The resources investment boom saw a marked change in the population dynamics in WA. Population growth picked up from 1% per annum in 2002 to 3.5% at its peak in 2008. It's now back in WA at about 1.5%. So incomes also grew very strongly with the resources boom. The construction response again followed with a lag, but the strong inward migration turned to outward migration once the resources cycle turned and incomes declined too. Housing construction continued past the turn in the cycle, contributing to the price dynamics in WA that I'll come to shortly. But one reason for highlighting the difference in construction cycles between the East and the West Coast is to illustrate the point that these very marked differences occurred across the country despite the same interest rate prevailing. This means that it's not just interest rates that matter for housing, which is not generally what you read in the newspaper. Other fundamentals such as population growth, incomes, and lags on the supply side were important drivers of the construction and price cycles on both the East and the West Coast. That said, interest rates do play an important role. The cost of finance is clearly an important consideration. So residential construction grew from 2012 to be about 6% of the economy at the beginning of 2016, and it stayed around there for the next 3 years. And this was around about the highest share of the economy it's been in the past more than the last couple of decades. So while the supply response to the increase in population growth in the mid-2000s took some time, in the end it did actually come. And that increase in supply has worked to address the increase in demand. And hence it's not surprising to see construction activity decline now, particularly when it's combined with a decline in demand from foreigners, as well as from domestic investors in a market where prices are falling and also facing somewhat tighter credit conditions. So since September last year, residential construction activity has declined by 9%. The decline has been broad-based across both detached and higher density housing, as well as spending on renovations. Nevertheless, the pipeline of work to be done remains at a high level, particularly for higher density projects in New South Wales and Victoria, though it has declined in most states. So you can see there that the residential pipeline in the country basically got as large as it's ever been in the last few decades, and particularly so in New South Wales and Victoria. But you can also see there that the WA cycle was a fair way in advance of the one on the East Coast. So I'm from Adelaide originally, and we just don't have housing cycles there at all. Or population growth. So given the size of the pipeline, we had expected construction activity to remain at a pretty high level for most of this year, but it turned down sooner and by more than we had expected. The fall has been larger in higher density than in detached, but still sizable in each. But even so, as you can see from there, much of the downturn in construction activity is still ahead. So building approvals are around about 40% lower, which is a decent number, than their peak in late 2017. So we are forecasting a further 7% decline in dwelling investment over the next year, and there is some risk the decline could be larger. So that will directly subtract around 1 percentage point from growth, from aggregate growth from peak to trough, given that dwelling investment accounts for around 6% of GDP. So that's a decently large whack to economic growth. The effect of the downturn in housing construction on the broader economy, though, is likely to be somewhat larger than 1 percentage point, given the linkages the sector has with other sectors, parts of the economy. For example, the residential construction sector has linkages to the business sector through, obviously, through things like architects, draftspeople and construction engineers, and to the manufacturing sector through steel and bricks and the like. The residential sector, construction sector itself accounts for around 2% of total employment. As you can see there, when we look more broadly, just under 6% of employment is closely related to the residential construction sector. So as the residential construction downturn continues over the next year, the impact will be felt in these sectors too. However, before this comes across as too gloomy, there are a number of mitigants. Firstly, depending on the skills they have, a number of these workers can shift to the non-residential construction sector, the infrastructure sector, for instance, where activity is at a very high level and is likely to remain so in the period ahead. Secondly, while there's a significant downturn in prospect over the next year or so, some of the contacts in the industry that we talk to have said that they can see through the trough in activity to the other side. So while the increase in supply has probably finally met the earlier increase in demand from the mid-2000s, demand is going to continue to grow given population growth is still around about 1.75% across the country. But supply is going to decline. So now supply has finally caught up to demand just in time for supply to drop off, but demand's going to keep on going. So there's quite likely to be a shortfall again in housing in the foreseeable future. Hence, some large developers tell us they're prepared to retain their workforce through the coming trough in activity. That said, the outlook for smaller contractors, which are quite prevalent in the housing sector, is not so great in the period ahead. So having talked a bit about the construction side of the economy, let me talk about the price cycle of the economy, which is one that most people are generally particularly interested in. And the price cycle is generally about the established market. So around 70% of housing sales are from the existing housing stock. So even in the peak of the construction cycle last year, when we're building all those, particularly rebuilding all those apartments, at a time when the number of sales in the established market was actually quite low, at most 50% of turnover in the housing market, or sales in the housing market, came from newly built housing. So the house price cycle is very much a story about the established market. Turnover in the housing market is very much an established story, not a new story. But clearly they are both closely related. And they are linked by the unavoidable fact that everyone has to live somewhere. And that's a fundamental force in the housing market that always needs to be kept in mind. How many people live in each dwelling can change, but that's generally slow moving. It is affected by social forces that influence average household size, as well as economic forces like price, rents, and income, but they move much more slowly. So the house price circle has turned, but in the opposite way to the construction cycle. And again, the picture is very, very different across the states. It also differs across cities within states and even across suburbs within cities. And a large part of these differences reflect different population dynamics, particularly migration flows across the different cities. So this is an index. This is not the absolute level of prices, because Sydney prices on average are more expensive than Melbourne prices. Although there was a period of time for a while where Perth prices actually became more expensive than Sydney prices, but that's clearly reversed now. So the price cycles in Sydney and Melbourne reflected similar dynamics to the construction cycle I talked about earlier. So the very large run-up in prices in Sydney and Melbourne reflected a large increase in demand, which outpaced the increase in new supply. Some part of the increase in demand was a result of lower interest rates, but there were other stronger factors such as population growth and foreign demand. These factors played out differently across the different cities, contributing to the differences in price dynamics. And again, it's worth remembering that the same interest rate applied across all of these cities throughout their considerably different price cycles. And that's particularly been the case over the past decade. So in contrast to the cycle from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s, which was more uniform across the states and more clearly reflected related to the shift down in the nominal interest rate structure through the 90s. So the price cycles in Melbourne and Sydney have been particularly stark. So prices in those cities increased by 58 and 75% respectively from 2012 to 2017. So in 5 years, house prices in Sydney went up by 75%. Prices turned down in 2017, again, not the result of rising interest rates. To a large degree, the cycle was likely to turn given the large run-up in prices, though the exact timing of this was hard to predict. The increase in the supply of new housing also contributed, as did the decline in foreign demand. The tightening in lending standards that occurred from around 2014 also played a role. Once prices started to turn down, investors pulled back, not being willing to buy into a falling market, and this contributed to the downward pressure on prices. So prices have declined by 11 and 15% in Melbourne and Sydney, respectively. But over the past few months, as you can see there at the end, the cycle has turned again in Melbourne and Sydney. That's coincide with the lower cash rate and mortgage rates, as well as APRA's recent changes to the interest rate threshold. In addition, it's possible that prices had fallen far enough to rekindle some demand. But as you can see there, at the same time, prices in Darwin and Perth have continued to decline. Lower interest rates have not been enough to outweigh the impact of other drivers of housing prices in those two regions, including sharply lower population growth. So turnover in the housing market declined to historically low levels earlier in the year. In fact, very historically low levels earlier in the year. So this is turnover in the established housing market. So earlier this year, that was the lowest level of houses turned over in the market we'd seen in more than three decades. This turnover itself has had a large number of macro impacts beyond just on real estate agents, which I'll come to shortly. Earlier I talked about the direct effect of the downturn in residential construction and some of the spillovers to other parts of the economy, including through employment. So now I'm just going to go into that in a bit more detail and how that has actually translated into slower growth right across the economy. So part of that has been reflected in decline in income for small businesses, which is evident in the national accounts. So there's this thing called gross mixed income, which you can basically think of the income of small business. That's declined by nearly 4% over the past year. Some part of that is because of the drought, but a sizable part is low income growth from contractors in the residential construction sector. That's contributed to the overall historically low growth in household incomes and therefore to lower growth in consumption. So aggregate growth in disposable income in the country, so how much income each household's got, has slowed from 4% at the end of 2017 to 2% by the end of 2018. We think this explains around half of the recent slowdown in consumption. The decline in housing prices has also led to a fall in household wealth. Our standard estimate of the wealth effect is that if house prices fall 10%, consumption tends to fall by about 1.5%. So given the decline in housing prices that has occurred, we estimate this accounts for the other half of the recent slowdown in consumption growth. So the housing sector itself has had its direct effect of subtracting about 1 percentage point of growth from the economy. But the effect of the decline in house prices on the effect of the decline in construction on income of tradies and the like, as well as the effect of lower house prices through the wealth effect, has contributed almost the same again in terms of slowing consumption growth. And as I mentioned earlier, the fall in housing prices has been accompanied by very low housing turnover effect. So some part of that wealth effect is likely to be related to the not surprising fact that when people move house, they tend to buy a lot of goods to stick in the house. In the past, housing prices and turnover are moved in lockstep, so it's been difficult to determine the impact of each channel. This time around, though, but with prices starting to grow again now, but turnover so far only picking up a little from its lows, we may get better sense of what has been the bigger drag, wealth or turnover, and hence now that what the outlook for consumption might be now that the housing cycle has actually turned. The fall in house prices and turnover has also reduced stamp duty revenue for state governments, but by and large, they've kept on spending on their infrastructure projects, so that hasn't had a pro-cyclical impact in the way that it might have had in the past. And finally, a related measure on the measured GDP growth has been this obscure part of the national accounts called ownership transfer costs, which basically reflects things such as stamp duty fees paid to real estate agents and the like. Normally, I wouldn't talk about this, but it by itself has taken 0.5 percentage point off growth over the past year. So the effect of the housing sector on the slowdown in growth over the last year or two has actually been a first-order impact. The other area where the spillover from housing to the rest of the economy has been larger than we had expected is its impact on inflation. which I'll show you, run through now. Housing inflation has two main components. They're rents and new dwelling purchase, the cost of a new dwelling purchase by an owner occupier. Those two things together account for around about 1/6 of the total CPI basket. So housing, established housing prices themselves aren't in the CPI. The effect of housing in the CPI comes through rents and through the cost of building a new place. So since 2017, the new dwelling purchase component of the CPI has reflected the cost of building higher density housing as well as detached housing. And despite activity in the residential construction being at the highest level it'd been in a number of decades, there was not much pressure on building costs. So you can see there, the yellow bars went up a bit, but actually not all that much given how strong activity was in the sector. What you can see there, that is, as the housing cycle has turned down, the cost of building a new house has come down a lot. That hasn't been so much in the form of price discounts, it's rather been in the form of add-ons such as a new kitchen and a better fit-out. So the developer will throw in a new kitchen for you or a better fit-out, and the in the same price, and the ABS treats these in-kind discounts as quality improvements, and that translates into a material reduction in the cost of detached housing in the CPI. So that's been a big drag on inflation. You can see it's barely contributing to inflation at all at the moment. And on the rental side, the large addition to the stock of housing, and particularly higher density housing, have had an impact on rents, particularly in Sydney, where the rental vacancy rate rose sharply to be its highest level in 16 years. So the rental vacancy rate in Sydney is the green line there. So as all these new apartments have come on stream, the vacancy rate in Sydney has shot right up. You can see that it hasn't moved much at all in Melbourne. So in Melbourne, the substantial increase in new housing supply has been largely absorbed by strong population growth there. And as a result, what we've seen is that rents have fallen, they're actually falling in Sydney at the moment. You can see in Perth the very large decline in rents there, although advertised rents have actually finally started to pick up there. So the combination of those two things has also been, of the lower rents, has been a material drag on inflation as well, or not providing much impetus to inflation. So you can see, historically, rental inflation has been a decent contributor to inflation. At the moment, it's basically contributing nothing. So the housing sector at all combined has been a big drag, contributed a lot to the low inflation outcomes we've seen over the last couple of years. Finally, it's important to also look at lending and credit growth and how those have interacted with the construction and housing price cycles. I don't think there's much sign of a credit crunch out there. I said that last year, and I still think that's the same. There's a tightening in lending standards from 2014 onwards, but through the first part of that, housing lending continued to grow at a fast pace. There was a further tightening. I'll show you what's going on with credit growth here at the moment. So the first part of the tightening in lending standards, credit growth continued at a decent pace for both owner-occupiers and investors after investors slowed a bit after the 10% cap on investor lending, but then it came back. But credit growth started to slow materially in mid-2017. Investor demand has slowed to such an extent that the stock of lending to investors has actually fallen in recent months. I think that primarily is a decrease in investor demand given falling house prices rather than the impact of tighter lending conditions. Throughout this, competition for high quality borrowers with standard loan applications has remained strong. In the end, it's difficult to separate the effect of demand and supply, but this strong competition suggests it's more of a demand story or lack of demand story than a supply story. We are seeing a number of borrowers taking advantage of this strong competition by refinancing to lower rates. This, along with continued switching from higher cost interest-only loans to principal and interest loans, amounts to a reduction in the average rate mortgage rate paid by people of around a basis point a month. So each month, the average rate paid is coming down by about a basis point as people refinance to cheaper loans. There's still plenty of scope for more of this to occur, given that the interest rate on a new loan is some 30 basis points below the average outstanding rate for owner-occupiers. So I know it's got a bit of coverage in the last 24 hours or so, but the facts are that the average rate for owner-occupiers is around about, that people are paying at the moment, is about 30 basis points higher than the average new rate out there. I know borrowers have different characteristics, but there's still a fair bit of refinancing that, that people can undertake to lower rates. So if you haven't done so, go out there and do it. So following the recent 75 basis point reduction in the cash rate, on average, variable mortgage rates have declined by around 60 basis points. Interest rates are historically low. Are we going to see a material increase in borrowing again as a result? So while turnover in the housing market remains low, which it is at the moment, credit growth is likely to remain low even as house prices pick up. So we can have house prices pick up without much credit growth going on behind it. And in fact, that's sort of what happened over the last 5 or 6 years or so, even in Melbourne, Sydney, when those rapid growth in house prices, there wasn't all that much growth in, relatively, that much growth in credit. Households today may be more conservative in their willingness to borrow given low income growth. Lenders are applying tighter lending standards than in the past, and both of these may well combine to result in more muted pickup in lending than in the past. Loan approvals have begun to rise, but we've yet to see this throw to a pickup in housing credit growth, as you can see here. One issue that we are closely monitoring is the extent to which households choose to take advantage of lower interest rates to pay down their mortgages faster rather than spend it. This would be evident in an increase in loan approvals that isn't accompanied by an increase in credit growth. So while I believe that the slowdown in housing credit is more a result of weaker demand and supply, it is having, there is definitely an impact of tightening in lending standards on the developer sector. And that may well inhibit the ability of supply to respond as demand keeps on growing. So let me now bring all this together. There's a sizable downturn in construction underway. The contacts in our liaison program indicate that demand for new houses and apartments has remained around the low levels of late 2018, even as prices have started to come up. The typical lags between the sale and construction of new dwellings imply that the decline in construction is going to continue for some time yet, despite the recent signs of stabilisation in the established housing market. And I've highlighted that the effect on the economy is greater than the direct effect of just the decline in construction, with significant spillovers to other parts of the economy and also inflation. But 2020 looks like being the low year for the residential construction sector. We can see through the trough to the other side. Demand is still continuing to increase given population growth. There are pockets of, while there are pockets of oversupply, particularly in parts of Sydney, where the vacancy rate is high, they are not widespread. Prices have turned in Melbourne and Sydney, which probably brings the investor back into the market. But the long lead times and higher density construction mean the supply response is likely to be low. And the tight conditions on lending to developers may mean it is even more protracted. And so the growth in demand without a meaningful supply response is going to lead to an even larger price response in a year or two's hence. From a financial stability perspective, that's not so much an issue if it's accompanied by a material expansion in borrowing. But house price increases clearly have a distributional impact. That's something that monetary policy is not well placed to address. Instead, monetary policy is concerned about aggregate outcomes for inflation and unemployment. In that regard, unemployment is a bit higher than it was at the beginning of the year, and there's not been much upward pressure on wages. And in turn, that has contributed to the extended run of inflation outcomes below the medium-term target range. And as I've just showed you, that downturn in housing, the housing cycle has also contributed to that. As a result, the board has decided to ease monetary policy in recent months, and these actions have taken account of the expected evolution in the housing cycle that I've just talked about. With these actions, with these policy actions, we're trying to seek to make more assured progress towards both full employment and the inflation target. So I hope that gives you some context about what's going on out there in the housing sector at the moment. As I said, in terms of domestic disruption, it's about as the largest first order force out there at the moment, and it's going to be so over the next year or two, potentially in opposite directions. So let me finish there, and happy to take any questions. Thanks.
How much do you think the housing market in Australia has sort of become a tradable commodity? We always talk about the foreign investor and the Chinese money. How much is that playing into our market?
I think it definitely contributed to the dynamics of the most recent price cycle, clearly here in Sydney and in Melbourne. It's been hard to get a handle on how much exactly it's contributed, but certainly did contribute to that. And the pullback in foreign demand as particularly out of China over the last few years, has probably played some role in the downswing as well. So I certainly think it's played a role, but I don't think it's necessarily played as much a role as some have emphasised. But it's played a bigger role than it has for a few years. Although if you think back over the course of modern Australian history, you know, we've had large amounts of foreign demand or demand coming from offshore into the housing market with various migration flows through time. This time around, as you said, there may be more of buying it as a store of wealth rather than as a place to live. But you know, foreign demand of one sort or another has always played a fairly large role in the Australian housing market. Sorry, down the front.
Thanks. You didn't mention housing affordability, which is obviously a key issue. So I hope perhaps you could share some reflections on housing affordability and also the impact of potential rates of declining home ownership on retirement incomes and retirement incomes policy.
Okay, so that's what I was referring to at the end when I said that the rising house prices clearly have a distributional impact, is very much about housing affordability. And as I said, in the end, that's not something we can do so much about. Some part of it is actually related to the supply response and also in terms of building affordable housing. I mean, there's interest in build-to-rent, for instance, at the moment, which from an investment point of view is an interesting proposition, and that seems to be gaining some momentum around at the moment. Home ownership rates actually haven't changed that much over the last 30, 40 years now. It's actually remained... they've actually remained fairly stable. So that hasn't changed all that much. But as I said, clearly house price movements do have large distributional effects in terms of affordability, in terms of whether your parents own a house. So there's a large intergenerational aspect to it as well. As much as retirement incomes policy, I think the intergenerational aspect probably is at least as much an issue. But in the end, as I said, that's something we can't do so much about. It's very much more an issue around the supply side and the like. Thanks. Down middle there.
Thank you very much for that speech. It was terrific. My question is around, I guess, the outlook for the bank in terms of employment and infrastructure having to really soak up the residential construction employment, and whether the bank has a view. It seems to me that the outlook for stability is really predicated on the ability for the infrastructure sector to soak up that employment. And does the bank have a view on the fungibility of, you know, kind of a chippy installing kitchens in a multi-complex apartment to the infrastructure sector?
So I'm going to get right into the exact detail of whatever skill you've got, how transferable you are. But we have actually, there has been a decent amount of people shift from out of the residential construction sector over the last couple of years into the into the infrastructure sector. And as you say, it partly depends on what your skill set is, and not all of those are completely transferable. But one thing which I talked about earlier is, so the infrastructure spend is going to stay at a high level for the foreseeable future, basically. And one thing we've also been talking about, which is the Treasurer and the State Treasurers have talked about recently, is also looking at not just the big infrastructure projects like you can see outside here, but smaller projects, more scalable projects around the country. And that probably fits better with the sort of transferability of the skills that you were talking about as well. And so I think there is still some scope there. There's probably not much more scope to start digging another tunnel in Sydney in the next little while, and wait until the existing project, the pipeline of the existing projects rolls off, and start to make sure you maintain that pipeline. I think both state governments here have got that. Here in Victoria particularly, have got that fairly well thought out. But that said, the other thing to point out is that, you know, it is, I think you can see through the trough in residential construction, which is going to it's going to be worse before it gets better, but through to the other side, and we may well find ourselves with a decently large undersupply of housing in a couple of years' time. Sorry, maybe take one more question. One there and then one back over there.
You did mention about the inventory growing in terms of the high-rise, and we now know that there are a lot of apartments that are sort of empty waiting for the new family to move in. But on the contrary, there are concerns around the quality of build that has probably happened in the last 5 years when there was growth. What could be the worst-case scenario in terms of paralysis at that 500 to 1 million range where most families or immigrant families would be looking at home? And there is a wait period that goes on too long, which obviously hurts the inflation.
Slightly straying outside my expertise in terms of not a property assessor. But so what we have heard when we've talked to, so there's a differentiation across quality. So the quality builders are actually regarding this as an opportunity, that they are able to emphasise their quality, the quality, their history of their, you know, historical quality, and that's they can use that as a selling point, and they are using that as a selling point. I think another thing you can look at is whether the developer has a share in the building, and it tends to be that if they have some, you know, if they have some skin in the game, they tend to care. That tends to help in terms of the overall quality of the building, and you can again differentiate that. As I said, it's not something which, we hear about it a lot in our discussion with people in the sector. In the end, what that means is some of the supply which has come to market isn't going to meet the demand which was there, which is potentially actually further exacerbates any potential supply-demand imbalance. Down the back there.
Thanks very much for your talk. It seems to be an implication of what you're saying, that you expect house price growth to exceed income growth. If that's the case, please could you comment on how macroprudential considerations have evolved over the last couple of years?
So I don't think macroprudential considerations are about house prices. They're about lending standards and the quality of lending. And that's one point I was sort of alluded to during the talk, is that house prices and lending aren't the same thing. They're often highly correlated, but they don't have to be. They don't have to be the same thing. And from a prudential point of view or a macroprudential point of view, it's the quality of the lending that's really the most paramount consideration. Those measures weren't aimed at house prices. They're aimed at ensuring appropriate lending standards. So that's very much the filter, I think, which you should think about it. Maybe call it quits there. Okay. Thanks very much.